Somebody loves me, I wonder who. I wonder who she can be.
Happy New Year, everybody, somebody, and welcome to the John Williams Show. I am Rick Kogan, filling in. I am sitting here with Ben Cortez, long time engineer here, the engineer of my bygone, lamented, legendary morning show. Ben, these are your last 2 hours at WGN.
I know, it's so much fun.
You look so happy.
Yeah, well, yeah.
You look unbelievably happy. This has become something of a tradition of mine, certainly, and a tradition for many of you, given your response online and Facebook and Twitter, to talk booze, because it is the time where everybody who doesn't know how to drink thinks they need to drink. I'll tell you something. A long time ago, a guy came to Chicago named A.J. Liebling, and he noticed a lot of things here. He was here in the 40s and wrote a series of articles for The New Yorker that later was collected in book form that would become really famous for giving this city its second city nickname. This was one of his observations. Quote, "A thing about Chicago that impressed me from the hour I got there was the saloons. New York bars operate on the principle that you want to drink or you wouldn't be there. If you are civil and don't mind waiting, they will sell you one when they get around to it. Chicago bars assume that nobody likes liquor and that to induce the customers to purchase even the minute quantity they have to provide a show." What he ignores in that is that bars, to my mind, are mostly about the people who work in those bars. I have three of the reasons that someone should go. I know one of you has been on the wagon for 4 months and is afraid that if you listen to this show, you will fall off the wagon, but that's not my problem. I have in here Jeff McGill, late of the Billy Goat Tavern, Colin Cordwell of the Red Lion Pub, and Bruce Elliott of the Old Town Ale House. Happy New Year, guys.
Happy New Year. And by the way, you look way too young to retire.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. Yeah, they kind of took a chance on a 4-year-old to start working here, and it seemed to work out.
Well, you've been great, Ben. You've been great. Why do people drink, Jeff McGill? Why do they go to bars? Why do they go to taverns?
You know, Rick, I always thought that people went primarily to it's a blow off steam, maybe escape from something, but also to connect also, and connect with kind of the unknowing. I mean, whoever they might run into in a tavern, there's always that kind of opportunity when you walk into a place. And it's funny that the old neighborhood taverns of Chicago were actually all very accommodating, actually. I remember years ago, we'd be out for something. It was an old professor of mine. Actually, it wasn't one of his students, but we became friends on campus. And we'd stop, if we were on our way, we'd stop just about anywhere on the north or northwest side to have a drink. And I don't recall ever feeling anything but absolutely welcome. And somehow connecting with the local neighborhood people, if we wanted to, if we kind of, you know, got away from our own conversation. The only time that may have been a little different is that we stopped in an old saloon up by Damon and Foster. And it occurred to me later, I said, we might have gotten a little bit of the fisheye in this place. And it occurred to me later that was probably, yeah.
Colin, what do you think it is? Why do people come to the Red Lion?
Once you get past your adolescence, you realize that you are the Everlast bag with a Wilson on it, and life is punching the heck out of you. And I think it's a suspension of reality.
Bruce?
Well, as
you have been, I would hazard to say,
I've been in bars longer than anybody in this room.
Yes, that's true.
I think it's, for me, it's really my social life. I mean, I much prefer the society of people in bars than the society of any other people. The wonderful thing about a bar is there's a bunch of stools. If you don't like the one or the person you're sitting next to, if you're at a relative's party and you get stuck by, or somebody, or a wedding, you get stuck by somebody's aunt, you have to be pleasant. You've got to be reasonably pleasant. In a bar, you don't. You can just walk down the bar. And I think that bars perform all kinds of valuable functions. I mean, it just was Christmas, and it reminded me of the old days where you would see people, and the Old Town Ale House is open every day of the year, and I think O'Rourke's was too, which was down the street, yeah. Another great old school bar. And it was so much fun to be in on a Christmas day and see people come in that you never see in a suit any other time, come in loosening their tie, not even saying hello to the gang, just going to the other end of the bar, having about four or five quick shots before they could pull themselves together, and then coming back and rejoining. Bars are really, they're social for people that really... you can, and if you've got a good instinct, you can go to any city, and you can kind of find a bar that fits your needs, and they're extremely valuable.
You three have, Jeff McGill, Colin Cordwell, and Bruce Elliott, have seen what I would call a sea change in the nature of and number of bars over the last, let's say, 40 years. We're all in our 60s here. Colin, you may not be.
Oh, I am.
Oh, yeah.
No, I'm 78.
I got parts of me.
And Bruce is in his
70s.
Bruce is in his 70s.
Who would ever guess?
Your places are all still immensely popular. Why, Jeff? Why was the Billy Gunn? And we're going to get into what kind of withdrawal he is feeling, not being behind the bar for an entire year. What is the popularity of the Billy Goat based on? It used to be within stumbling distance of four major newspapers. It's not anymore.
No. And certainly that was, that obviously, garnered considerable attention.
Steady crowd.
And
also, I have to say, too, I'd love for you to address, too, the drinking habits, I think, have vastly changed, where now bartenders are called mixologists. And
get me on
I do want to get
now
you
now where
there.
I hang.
I do want to get you. Sorry, Jeff, go ahead.
Sure. And obviously, the Billy Goat enjoyed a very unique location on top of it, which was kind of added to its appeal, I think. Indeed, Rick, drinking patterns have changed. Most people, I would say, probably could get away with having a drink at lunch when I started working there back
in
the early
80s. Yes, they could.
That's not the case anymore. We know that. It's interesting, though, that despite the obvious notoriety that they were able to glean from Reichel's writings,
the curse,
proximity to the newspapers, that so much of that place still operated like an old neighborhood.
No question. That's why I liked it. That's one of the main reasons I think, Bruce, you too. Like the Billy Goat, we could go in there and find you.
Well, and also, don't forget the price. I mean, you look around.
Exactly, downtown, right.
Ridiculous. I mean, the first time I ever had to pay $5 for a beer, I thought it was the end of the world.
It may well have been.
How glad the many millions of Annabelle.
It's Frank Sinatra, me, Rick Cogan, Jeff McGill, Colin Cordwell, and Bruce Elliott talking about the nature of Chicago taverns. They are, I think, they are not unique. Each one of their places, Jeff used to work at the Billy Goat, Colin at the Red Lion, and Bruce Elliott is a constant presence. He doesn't work much there except when he's doing his podcast. At the Old Town Ale House, these are three of the most distinctive places. Jeff was talking about what it was that made the Billy Goat. So, Colin, you have a bar that was started by your dad as a kind of in a sort of falling down old building on Lincoln Avenue, just north of Fullerton. You have turned that place into as beautiful a bar restaurant as I've ever seen. How has that changed the clientele?
You know what? We still get a lot of that type of clientele. I actually hang an Irish flag up. It's my insurance policy against the IRA. It kind of calms tempers. I said, my God, give it a break. But anyway, I found I had a latent ability for interior design. I had no idea what this place was going to look like when I redid it. The previous Red Lion probably should have been torn down during the Second World War.
No kidding.
And I said the only thing keeping together were the termites holding hands. And
well, I saw it torn down.
Oh yeah, remember? And I said, wait, I changed my mind.
Yeah, yeah. I know. Bruce, the alehouse is as venerable a saloon as there is, and it has retained somehow that neighborhood feel, as, and I grew up in Old Town, as that neighborhood has rarefied beyond what I ever could have expected. That's why I think it is an essential part of the Old Town neighborhood and the city of Chicago. How your the previous owners and the current proprietors, how's it been able to happen? I mean,
it's been transformed. It's
by your artwork.
Well, no, but I mean, as the neighborhood changed, the bar changed, and was the bar adjusted. The guy that invented it was a guy named E.J. Van Gelder. He was a brilliant guy at building bars and hiring bartenders, and he was just absolutely one of the most loathsome, disgusting human beings that ever drew breath. And when he finally, and in the old days, the early 60s, it was founded in 1958, in the early 60s, it was, there was no TVs, it was strictly classical music, and Fridays, if you brought in an album, they might play show tunes. And it had a mix, it was not uncommon to see socialites like Roger McCormick in Tuxes come in on the weekends, but then you had a blue collar. You did have actors, the people from the Second City would have come in and see.
And the folkies from
we really miss the Old Town School folk music because that was a great thing to have in, you know, the neighborhood, and it was too bad that they left. But then when Van Gelder figured out up where Count, he thought Lincoln Avenue was going to be the spot. And he sold the bar to some moron who just, like, lasted about a year with him. And then he had to, thank God, a bunch of these crazy alcoholics that were from Figaro's, the old Figaro's down on Rush Street,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
Pooled their resources and bought it. And no sooner did they buy it than it burned down. So I think about 30 or 40 drunks lifted up the bar of the Old Town Ale House, carried it out, blocked off North Avenue, and walked it through right across the little side street into a Pete's Butcher Shop. And practically the bar practically didn't miss a beat. But then it was no longer people in tuxes. That was over. Made it a 4 o'clock bar. It was a rough, tough bar for a while when the neighborhood got rough. And but the one thing that always kind of kept, you always had the actors, you always had the comics, and another great element was after the other bars closed, the old-time jazz guys would come in. And so you always had this great jukebox because of the jazz guys. They kept it going. So.
One of the things, too, and I want to talk to Jeff about this, too, and ask Colin, one of the things was when Roger Ebert, certainly at O'Rourke's, he made well-known and famous. But Roger Ebert, and more recently, the late, your really good friend and a really good guy, Anthony Bourdain, that kind of celebrity wound up attracting certain people, as Royko
did I think
at the Goat.
Royko's the perfect example for Billy Goat. I mean, Billy Goat's, I mean, now that they don't have
Jeff,
the newspapers.
And Jeff.
Well, Jeff, I mean, you can walk in there now. Don't dare ask somebody behind the bar who the pictures of the people on the wall are.
No.
Because he wouldn't have a clue. So it's, but it's got such a reputation. And Royko really, to me, made the Billy Goat. I mean, that's why I would go down. I just see Mike Royko and Studs. And
you see, a lot of people made that mistake, did they not, Jeff, to see. They wanted to go down and see, not only see, but have a wonderful, lively conversation with their great hero, Mike Royko. That didn't always work out for people, did it?
Hey, Jeff, tell that story about when, I mean,
the autograph?
That autograph story. Tell that story.
And again, as I've told him before, it was not uncommon. The circumstance that Rick describes, that somebody would be in the Billy Goat and like, geez, this is my lucky day. That's him. That's Royko. And they come, they confirm with me first. Is that Mike? Yeah, it is. But, you know, maybe you want to be crying. Okay, I got you. And very, they can hardly wait, and they get up to the bar and walk down to him and say, hey, you know, Mike, you know, maybe some guy. So look at my aunt, read your column every day, and I really don't want to bother you, but could you just sign something for me? Jeff, get me a bag. And I got to pay one of the paper bags we kept behind the bar for carry out. And he said, what's your aunt's name? It's Marge. And he,
more than once. And the great thing is, you know that bag is framed in like a basement in Arlington Heights somewhere. Yeah. Colin, you have notable people coming in, always have at the Red Lion, too. A lot of actors would come in there.
Oh, yeah. Brian Denny used to be right. He was a nice guy. You know, I remember William Peterson.
Billy.
He and I used to do the Jewish triathlon together at Lakeshore Athletic Club.
What is that?
A sauna, steam, whirlpool. I wouldn't recognize him with his clothes on. You know? He came and he used to do the Irish handcuffs, you know, a shot and a beer.
Well, we'll end that segment with this and get some commercials in and can carry on with Jeff McGill, Colin Cordwell, Bruce Elliott, all long time and dear friends of mine, but also very wise and forthright human beings. We'll be back after a couple commercials.
Embrace me.
Now, this song, I'm almost tempted to listen all the way through. That's a great song. It's Frank Sinatra. I'm Rick Kogan. I'm here with Jeff McGill, formerly of the Billy Goat, Colin Cordwell of the Red Lion Pub on Lincoln Avenue, just north of Fullerton, and Bruce Elliott of the Old Town Ale House on North Avenue, just west of Wells. I was just thinking in the conversation we were having off-air that this would be the most spectacular, if we could talk about the stuff we talk about off air, this would be the most spectacular podcast in the world.
Oh, it would eclipse Stern.
Oh, absolutely. We'd split the $35 million.
I'd have to go back to using my porn name.
I'm in.
Bruce, this year you started a podcast yourself at the Ale House with Liz Garibay, the booze historian.
Well, because it was, I didn't know what one was, but I didn't know what a blog was either until Ebert got me.
He has one of the geriatric geniuses,
right,
the name of his blog.
It's a phenomenal blog.
It is phenomenal.
Spectacular. But so is the podcast. My books are phenomenal. But Pub Crawl Liz was saying, yeah, we got to do a podcast. It was roughly like a radio. Well, it is like a radio show, except
no commercials.
You can say whatever the hell you want.
No news, no weather.
And it's very offensive. I was mentioning if we were on it as a sponsor, it'd have to be some type of pedophile website or something like that. But it's fun, and we got some great, you know, some old timers like Jim Toohey. Now, Jim Toohey is this kind of really legendary Chicago character. He's still standing. He's like 83.
It's amazing.
He is a gold standard for all alcoholics. Hank Ettinger used to be, and he made it into his 90s.
Jim is now the guy.
But Jim is amazing. He can still chug along like mad.
And he can still talk. I mean,
well,
he's
But you have to direct. I mean, he needs discipline. And that's
and
the
you
thing.
Would be the guy to do.
I'm great for directing Jim and getting the good stories. But yeah, we're going to slowly but surely try to get all the old timers that are still around. And
you got me.
It's called Yes, We Got You. That took courage. That took some courage. Andy Shaw, that took courage.
Andy was great.
Very good.
You have really interesting
very
people
good.
On
it's
the
It's called
thing.
As the Ale House Turns. You can just Google it.
Google that and you'll get it.
You'll get right on.
And it's fun for you.
Oh, I enjoy it. I mean, it's very much fun. And Liz is the perfect foil for me because she tries to control me.
Oh, and so fun. It is. It's like Burns and Allen. I mean, it's really.
That's a great.
It's a pretty amazing duo on that show. Colin, you're writing a book. We'll talk about Bruce's books. There are now. I'm the sort of official chronicler of Bruce's writing. There are three now.
Three.
The fourth is coming.
Well, it's taking on a life of its own. That's Chronicles of a Dung Beetle Warrior.
Chronicles of a Dung Beetle Warrior. Colin, you tell me you're writing a book based on
the
40-some years in this crazy tavern
business. Yeah, if you, I started during the golden age of boogie nights, you know, legally. You know, the golden age of better dressing through chemistry and herpes. And this is back in the late 70s. And the changes I've seen over the course of the last 40 years, these guys sitting next to me could just tell me absolutely, you know. And I finally got to a point where I said, you know, I've got to put this stuff down on paper.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm interviewing bar men, which is what we should segue into. What's the difference between a barman and a mixologist? Well, there's a lot.
What do you think? You know, the term mixologist drives me crazy.
It's a generational thing. You know, I always said a mixologist is somebody who couldn't get a date in a woman's prison with a pocket full of pardons. You know? A barman you're a barman.
Yeah. Jeff, you were a barman in the classic definition of that word for more than 30 years. You quit around this season last year.
That's 3 years ago.
How long?
It's 3 years now, Rick.
Three years?
Yeah. It's been 3 years.
3 years.
You hardly qualifies to be on this panel anymore.
Yes, you are. Yes, you certainly
are. I'm going to Al Lopez and pull him out of mothballs.
What have you missed? I mean, how has the transition been? I mean, you were there every day. Some days really boring, listening to bowling scores or whatever else was being said, but other days enlivening.
Yeah, obviously. I mean, living in a city like Chicago and being at that location, I mean, how can you not miss something? I mean, you know, not to be shop-worn about it, but if a city has a pulse, indeed. Indeed, if a city has a pulse, you're going to feel it in a place at that locale. And if you're there for 35 years, as I was, then you really kind of get sensitized to that, you know, to the kind of the metabolism of the city, if you will. So you miss that. Indeed, you do. I live out in the suburbs. I have for quite some time now.
A very thoughtful, philosophical guy. I mean, every time I've talked to you, you think. Have you ever thought of putting this down on paper? I know you did. I know you toyed with it that first year.
Yeah, you know, and it kind of ebbs and flows in my mind. It, you know, and I wake up at 3 a.m. and that's when these things seem to be most fluid for me. What I need to do is actually get up and you know, get it down on paper. And who knows? I mean, that's still an idea. You know, it's odd. A moment ago I was going to mention that you asked me about being away from the business. Maybe it's something about me personally, but my sentimentality kind of lags. It lags over time. And indeed, this time of the year, it kind of kicks in big. And you do miss these places. Bruce was referring to being open
every day.
365 days a year. The Billy Goat was 364. They closed on Christmas Day. But on Christmas Eve, the Tui family would come in. And you know, I got to tell you, I alluded to the something about that day. That was the day I retired 3 years ago.
Yeah.
It was Christmas Eve. And the specialness of the day, and I thought that I found symbolism in that, and I thought it was a good time to walk away, and I thought I could do so, you know, inconspicuously. But getting back to the Tuis, it was an honor for me when I would show up. And, you know, and half the time when I wanted to get home, my kids and my wife were waiting for me to get home and have dinner and do a little Christmas Eve tradition. And the Tuis are walking one right after another and just as, you know, as joyous as Tuis could be. And, of course, when they walked into the saloon, of course, they were always joyous, the Tuis.
Well, I got to talk about that Christmas Eve 3 years ago. I can't believe it's 3 years ago. But Jeff created a drink for the five-year-old Fiona Cogan. He called it a Fiona Sunrise, Sunshine. And so we're in there three Christmases ago, and I said, Fiona, this is Jeff's last day here. And as we're sitting at the bar, and she's getting this unbelievably sad look on her face. I go, it's okay. It's okay. He's going to do other things. And she looks at me and goes, but Dad, he's the only bartender I know. And I said, honey, keep it that way. I said, keep it, sweetheart, keep it, keep
good
it
luck
that
on
way.
That.
It certainly confirms the DNA that Fiona.
You know, what I think, too, and especially around the holidays, I think what people seek in a good tavern if they can find one, is shelter from the various storms of life. As you were talking before about Bruce, someone coming in a suit and tie and banging back four shots and then going out to be with the family. That's
mostly coming back from that.
Oh, shelter from the battering. Yeah. That is, I think, one of the essential things that taverns bring. And I often argued that taverns are as important to the sort of social fabric of a neighborhood as is a church if you're religious, as is a school if you go to school. And that shattered. I mean, Bruce, you were talking about the former mayor, Daley, cutting back the number of tavern licenses.
Over half.
Yeah.
During his 20-year reign, over half the liquor licenses are no more.
What do you think that does to a city?
I think it's a terrible, terrible, especially to the neighborhoods. As more and more neighborhoods become gentrified, they get rid of the yuppies don't like the neighborhood saloon, the concept. They don't like anything about it, and which is the character of the neighborhood, by the way. And I think that they probably feel it's bad for property values or whatever. Who knows what they think? But so you eliminate, and I've talked to people from coming from London saying that this some of those 200-300-year-old
I've heard that
bars
too.
Over there are going by because real estate's so valuable. But it's the character, and I mean, I you know, we went into the whole psychological reason why the Daleys were so who were big drinkers themselves, but were so down on bars. And I think Mrs. Daley actually, the late Mrs. Daley, really thought that the only place she should be allowed to have bars would be hotels. I mean, that's how down she was on them. Which is just nonsense, nonsensical.
Well, you'll hear the argument that, oh, well, look at bars, you know, cause alcoholism. I'm thinking to myself, wait a minute, you can buy a bottle of any kind of booze at Walgreens, for God's sake. You don't need that kind of environment. Jeff, you're eager to say something, I think.
Yeah. No, well, you know, you asked what was the value of bars, years ago I filled in for a girl that I went to college with. Her father needed somebody to kind of cover it, and he owned a neighborhood tavern up around Western and Wilson. And I remember that, you know, there was a cross section of that neighborhood would make its way into that tavern at some point. You got the old guys that would come in for their free Sunday drink, and that would be the only time you'd see them. But you'd listen to the conversations, and they would talk about, okay, listen, you got to move your car because there's street cleaning today, or this guy, this restaurateur down the block, is asking for a zoning variance. And that was the civic value of taverns. You don't get that any other way. Nobody else is going to inform you of these little details of your neighborhood, but that was the function that it had, and it was not insignificant. The regular Democratic organization precinct captain wasn't going to, you know, routinely inform you of everything that was going on. Taverns did that.
We got to take a break. I want Colin to talk about the fact that we're living, and all of you, in an increasingly icy age where people communicate by, you know, eight-letter text and this, and there is no... Taverns remain, as far as I'm concerned, one of the few remaining places where you know, sort of human beings gather.
Interact.
And talk. We're talking about the fact that the taverns... remain an oasis even in the onslaught of high technology of conversation. And that's, I think, Colin Cordwell, an essential and important element not only of taverns but of human life.
One thing I like about my place is that it isn't your average place. Like the last show we did when Bruce said, well, I'll tell you what a bar isn't. It's not 40 TVs on a wall. You know, they're laboratories for attention deficit disorder.
Yeah, yeah.
You're forced into conversation. People say, can you turn the music up? I said, no. I said, when it has your name out front, sure, you can do it. You know, but for me, I like to keep this anachronistic quality of, oh, you're going to do a tete-a-tete. I get more first dates in my place. You can't imagine. And I kind of referee it sometimes, too. I said, how's it going? Oh, it's all right. I said, you want to... really impress her? Keep your mouth closed. Ask her about herself. You know? I dated professionally for 29 years. I know.
Dated professionally for 29 years.
The Collins Bar has kryptonite for undesirable kids books. The kids walk into his bar. His bar is a great bar.
Oh, it's beautiful.
And it's a classic old English kind of bar. But there's books all over the place, and you see these kids. I mean, that's got to be disturbing to them.
No. It's funny, Rick, because we have a phenomenon called books. And it happened the other night. Four kids came in. Honestly, they don't get any closer than the hostess stand. They see the books. It has the same effect of holding a cross in front of a vampire. They're out of there like a set of jumper cables, a Lithuanian wedding.
Well, one of the great things about all three of these places, the Billy Goat, where Jeff McGill used to work, the Red Lion Pub, where Colin Cordwell holds court and works, and the Old Town Ale House, where you can find Bruce Elliott, not every day, but most days, there is a real, real sense of history on the walls. Jeff, in the case of the Billy Goat, it's history that people may not even... It sort of functions as a journalism museum, a de facto journalism museum, even though people may not know any of the faces or names on the walls. Is that an important element of that place?
Oh, I think it is indeed. It certainly was all the years that I was there. At least that's what I embraced. I really wanted to keep that part of it going. You know, people would come in and they'd ask about the Billy Goat curse and those things. And that's not insignificant, obviously, in the history of that business. But I always felt that the journalistic connection was the thing that we needed to hold on to. And even if these people come into that bar and look on that wall and see these old clippings and photographs of old journalists passed on, that they have some sense that there's a worthwhile history about this. And who knows how that may impact them then or down the line. But indeed, you know, we're in this game of trying to hold on as much as we can of what we've embraced, all of us here.
And I think in your case, Bruce, much of the history is in your artwork, in your fine, fine, and increasingly expensive.
Well, I can't argue with you about that.
Yeah, of course you can.
Now that my newest painting, and I'll try to keep this.
Yes.
Tasteful.
It's a very nice painting. I've seen. You can go to Bruce.
Let me just say the title is Golden Showers, and it's a family, kind of a family celebratory painting of the president, Stormy Daniels, and his wife and child. And I'm very pleased with it. And it's got just the exact response that I was hoping.
That you expected. What makes you choose what goes up on the wall? I mean, there are some.
Well,
there are portraits of many.
Well, I put putting portraits of. There's an old mural done in 1970-71 by commercial artist. Her name was Maureen Munson, and she did a wonderful job. She only would do people she liked. She'd bring them in and paint them directly on the wall. Well, over the years, it's got this nicotine patina. And most of the people on the wall are no longer with us. But so when my ex-wife and I took over the bar, she suggested I kind of follow up and start doing portraits. So I would do portraits of the people that hung around the bar. But then in 2008, I put up, as kind of a whim, a painting of Sarah Palin naked, holding a machine gun on a polar bear rug.
Which became an international sensation.
I had no idea about the internet until that day because I put it up on a Thursday. The kids from Second City classes came in, took pictures. The next morning when I opened the bar, I got a call at 8 in the morning from some publication in Paris. They wanted to know if they could run the... I said, how do you know? It's all over Europe. All the TV shows came in.
Oh, yeah.
The two big name papers, they tried to figure out how to
reproduce
this thing
distinctive painting.
And it went nuts. So I thought, well, that's once in a million. I was on over 100 shock jocks. And then I did Governor Blagojevich, a painting called Cavity Search, where he's going to jail. Same thing, except no death threats. We got death threats for Sarah, but not for Governor Blagojevich.
Yeah.
So, but then I have it now with Photoshop. I like to think I was kind of a pioneer.
A pioneer.
But Photoshopping now, people can do these outrageous pictures. You know, they can do 10 a day. So I had to think of something really unique for my latest President Trump tribute painting.
Colin, your place has the feel of, in many ways, a museum. I mean, it is an homage in part to your amazing dad, John Cordwell. How do people react to it? Do you think they sense it? Do you think they feel it? Do you think they get anything from it?
Yeah. You know, it's funny because one of my hobbies is looking at their faces as they're looking around. People are taking pictures all the time. I call it the Regenstein Library with a service bar. Yeah. You don't even need a card. He goes, how come the books are up high? So I said, so they don't walk out the door. That's why.
That is important. I have to, we also have Rock and Roll Ruth in here as the producer. I just want to tip of the hat to you because you produce the amazing Alehouse podcast. Do you want to say anything? Okay.
Well, her main job, by the way, is getting drinks for everybody.
That's true. Yeah, because it is not, it's probably not the only podcast that serves alcohol, but it's the only one I've been on. The only one I've been on. Jeffrey, you have not visited the Billy Goat much since you left, have you?
No, I haven't.
Why?
You know, it's funny, Rick. It had been a gradual process of kind of losing some of the old denizens of the, you know, of the downstairs, if you will, of that place. One person was noted earlier, old Hank Ettinger. You know, you realize what a treasure these people are, and I'm not saying that the new. There's always kind of a new, you know, influx of customers and
not as many though.
I don't know. And you really can't spread yourself that thin. I mean, and after a while, you realize that if I come down there, I'm not sure that there's much for me to access that I once felt a part of, and that's okay. That's okay. Things change, and there's a new group of people working down there. There's some of the same old ones. I should see Sam. He was very good to me. One of the things about Sam, of course, is that he always wanted to honor his uncle, who left him that business, so much so. I mean, part of that process, I should say, is that he wanted to preserve as much as he possibly could. And what a wonderful thing that turned out to be, because indeed it has, as you mentioned before, everything that's on the wall.
They have a new party room there, kind of a private area for the first time in the history. They used to sort of jerry-rig private
areas. Where's
that at? It's to the west. They took out a storage area, and they have in there, there's an amazing picture of Sam with Royko. It's a crowd that never would have been there. It's Sam and Royko, Dave Condon, Mike Royko, and Studs Terkel all together. Go in there and see it. We got a break for commercials and get some news, and I can carry on with these three fine gentlemen. The amazing Elif Garis is producing me, Rick Cogan, filling in for John Williams, and John always has the news click. Here it is today, ladies and gentlemen. You know how to deal with this. Governor-elect J.B. Pritzker might have an opportunity to sign a revised bill on gun shop oversight as one of his first tasks in office. A, he should sign it. B, he should veto it. Any of you who answer B, turn off the radio and hit your head against a wall. I'm continuing on with Jeff McGill, formerly, I cannot believe it's been 3 years, of the Billy Goat, Colin Cordwell of the Red Lion Pub, and Bruce Elliott of the Old Town Ale House. What, gentlemen, in your minds makes, at this time of year, a bunch of people are going out, they're going into bars and other places, getting loaded, for maybe the first time in their life. As we all know, drinking is not a game, but what makes a good tavern customer, Bruce?
Well, if it's your first time, don't come to my bar. I beg you. And we do everything to discourage that.
No experiments.
But, it's for me, of course, at my age, but even when I was young, just starting out in bars, I liked being around the older crowd. I was really interested in characters, learned all kinds of things. I mean, that's something that we haven't talked about. There's a lot to learn from older, wiser, interesting raconteurs and out-and-out eccentrics. And I loved it. And so I liked being around. I'm very uncomfortable in a bar where everybody's got their baseball hat turned backward. They're all looking at TV.
Yeah.
But a bar, yeah, an older, I like an older, slight older, interesting crowd. One problem that we've been running in lately is that the bar, thanks to Mr. Anthony Bourdain, is more popular than ever. And it's crowded a lot more than it used to be. And I think regulars don't like being in crowds. But nevertheless, they're very interesting people. It's still an older crowd coming in. And I don't know. I'm sure everybody, you might, if you're into sports, you're going to go find a sports bar or whatever. But
I think to your point, I think that's a very interesting point, is to be a good listener. Because in being a good listener and hearing these stories and being part of it, you will inevitably, one would hope, become a good conversationalist. Colin, you agree with that?
Well, in my business, I've talked to Jeff about this before, and he is grounded in psychology.
Yeah.
People will tell you exactly what they're about, but you got to listen. You know, I serve drinks, but I'm actually a psychiatric field medic. I get them on the front line when they're freshly wounded, you know.
Yeah.
And I deal with all kinds of issues, you know. And and everybody's got a story, too. Everybody wants to have a feeling of relevance. They want to have a feeling of relevance. They want to have a raison d'etre, you know. I actually do mean something to somebody. I always said that God invented bartenders, so everybody will have someone to talk to.
Yeah, that's Jeff, you must feel that way, too.
Yeah, no, indeed. You know, it's funny, but you know, the bartender's job, of course, is most importantly, is to kind of make the milieu as hospitable to everybody as you possibly can. And I was thinking, you know, some years back when I retired, shortly before I retired, they did a story about me, believe it or not, for Chicago Magazine. And I had a thought later on about how I should have characterized that experience, not the story, but the act of tending bar. And I said, you know, people in a tavern, I mean, you know, they make music together, again, to use a shop-worn phrase. But human beings, if they're honest rendering of themselves, they're virtuosos of themselves. And the only time that gets thrown off and it becomes either discordant or cacophonous, or when the phonies somehow get too loud a voice. And we can identify those people. Anybody who's been in the bar business knows who those people are, and you feel the imbalance. You feel the milieu shift. And so it's either the owner or the bartender's job to kind of, you know, either minimize that or, you know, kind of work that through.
Bruce, you must, you have met some phonies in your time in the bar business, on like every day.
Yeah, I but when I was on Anthony Bourdain, and he wanted me to kind of describe the difference between Chicago and certainly any place in California. I said, Chicago, you just can't get away with being a phony. It's people spotted here, so, pardon me, the BS.
Thanks for toning it down.
What does this stand for?
What does that mean?
Yeah, the phony doesn't work here. And I think that's a big difference. I think that does differentiate. And if you're in a bar, of course, you're going to get the blowhard.
Sure.
Like what Jeff's talking about. And they can be really, really. Now, if you've been around enough, you know what you can say to them. There's a whole lot of ways of dealing with that. But
right.
Some of them are just, and if a guy's real big, then that presents some other problems, too.
Now, you've had, over the years, Jeff, had to deal with all manner of interesting folks. There was one, and I hate to bring him up because it always makes you laugh, but there was a man who worked for the Tribune named John Wassel, who used to, on Fridays, he had just gotten divorced, and he used to dress in a cowboy outfit. Remember?
I do, Rick, indeed. You and I have talked about it often.
We have. And idiotically, I had John on. We were talking about saloons many years ago. And I asked John, what did I ask?
You said, John, on Fridays, I don't know how to put this, but you like to wear cowboy clothes.
And John answered. I mean, it was a very interesting thing. I think that there's a freedom that taverns represent, too, for a lot of people, you know, especially in a tightly wound society or a tightly controlled job.
Absolutely, Rick. And for him, and he's a good example. He was a wonderful guy, by the way. a very kind
question.
Human being. But you're right, he had gone through a very painful divorce, and this was a time, I think, that a lot of offices were instituting dress-down day on Friday.
Yeah, casual and Friday.
Casual Friday, but that was it. And John just had gotten into a thing of he was hanging out in a kind of a country western bar. It was over on Clyburn or something there, Clyburn and Racine, I want to say. And what was really happening, and I don't want to talk too much about John, but he was...
About him, we're talking about a lot of people.
Yeah,
really,
and he was kind of surviving on a kind of alter ego, if you will. But it was saving him from a lot of pain, and indeed the bar gave him a chance to kind of live out that part of his life that was going to make things better. And you know, thank goodness he had that. He had that refuge. He didn't have to just go home and
be alone.
Yeah,
I mean that's the other thing.
I came in the Billy Goat one time, and Jeff asked me, Do you know such a bear? He was a white, fairly small defensive back. And Jeff said, do you know? Because that guy, that's who he is, or he says he is. Do you know what he... I look at him, I said, I don't know. Maybe, I don't know. He said, well, he's a nice guy, and he's got some great stories, and he's buying drinks. And I think the guy would come in for a while, didn't he? And then one day Jeff told me, it turns out he wasn't.
He wasn't. No, he would come in, and he was, I'll tell you, he was kind of in a frenzy. There's a condition called pseudologia fantastica. It's not a psychosis, but it's where people develop such kind of an extensive, you know, alter ego that they kind of live within that for a time. And I don't know if it's alcohol would kind of throw him into that persona, but he was kind of masquerading as a former Chicago Bear. Somebody brought in a football card of the actual person sometime after I first been introduced to this guy. And so I was aware of the fact that this was not who he was. In fact, he was a plumber, as it turned out. But I said to people, I said, first of all, he was
in street. When I play Scrabble.
He would buy the customer. He would come in and buy the bar a drink. And he was a nice guy, as affable as can be. And, of course, he was very generous to me as well. So I gave everybody that I could instructions, look it. If he says who he says he is, that's who he is. For believe me, you'll benefit, he'll benefit, and I'll benefit. So.
That goes something I want to follow up on after a couple of commercials. That Roger Ebert, in once writing about O'Rourke's, or maybe he wrote it about O'Rourke's, where he was a constant customer. He said that O'Rourke's was our stage, and I think to that point, I want to pursue that with Colin and Bruce after the. Commercials, that is what it is for a lot of people. It really is a stage. Bruce and I go back with a far back, as does Colin and Jeff, with a guy named J. Robert Nash, who certainly took that to heart.
He's the greatest performer I ever saw.
We'll be back after I read you a couple things, and then you'll hear some professionals read you a couple things. This week on Chicago's Best, it's the best of the best, from tacos to burgers to the most drool-worthy. Tune in to see who won Chicago's Best of 2018, Sunday night at 10 on WGN-TV. And then, this holiday season, when you put money in the Salvation Army's red kettles, you're giving someone in addiction recovery the gift of hope, or a senior a hot meal, or a family a warm place to sleep. You're providing love and compassion. Everyday people turn to the Salvation Army to help keep the heat on, put food on the table, and keep their children safe from harm. And every day you make it possible for the Salvation Army to give that help. Every year, the Army serves more than 1 million people throughout Chicagoland. They provide housing, cure hunger, combat addiction, brighten the holidays, and much more. If there is a cause you're concerned about, the Salvation Army certainly addresses it. This year, give hope to a neighbor in need. Give to the Salvation Army at the iconic Red Kettles or online at the large donate button at www.salarmychicago.org/WGN radio. Welcome back. It's Rick Hogan filling in for John Williams. These fine gentlemen are going to be here till 1:45. That man out there who was worried that he might start drinking again after being sober for 4 months, listening to Jeff McGill, Colin Cordwell, and Bruce Elliott talk, stop drinking tomorrow, because we've been talking about taverns and what they mean. And we were just talking, Jeff brought up an interesting point, that for many, a tavern provides a stage and allows them to perform, whether it is pretending to be someone else or being more expansive than they might normally be. Bruce, you believe that to be true, of course.
Oh, absolutely. I hadn't thought of it quite like that, but yeah, I mean, it's the great characters, I mean, in a way, you'd watch, you know, Ebert in his own way would perform. You'd see him sitting at the goat down the spire from Royko. He had a whole persona, bar persona.
Yep.
And Royko's gruff, I mean, he wasn't, that's not how he, you know.
No.
He wasn't Mike, Mr. Warm and Cuddly, but that
Mike had one too, though.
But yeah, that was his performance.
It was a defensive.
It was a defensive thing.
Colin, you see that often?
You know, it's funny you should mention that, because there's such a weight on acting and actors in Hollywood in our culture. And it's like that song by Sly and the Family Stone, "Everybody is a Star." You know,
yeah.
I think there's so many wannabes that you didn't believe. I was an actor for 16 years. I tell people I was making too much money in theater. I'm trying to get in the bar business. And I see so many people who, this is their stage. Yeah. Yeah. The light's on me.
Yeah.
And when they go back out, it's like the curtain drops for them, you know. And I see it so, I get so many lonely people who can shine.
Only. In a tavern.
In the tavern.
Mm. You know, I think one guy who, and I'd love for you to talk to him a little about him, Bruce, one guy who seemed absolutely genuine and not that way was Anthony Bourdain, who discovered your place through Roger Ebert's.
He was a big fan of Roger.
And Roger wrote about the Ale House being a great saloon, and Bourdain came in. You did, what's the name of his show was?
Well, we did two. We did the first the show, I don't know what the hell, No
Parts Unknown. Or
I don't know.
Well, there's
this is Parts Unknown was the big one we did with us. But yeah, the first one he did, I don't Layover, I think it was called,
yeah.
Layover on Travel Channel.
And you were in part of that. The second one, which is you were in almost as much as he is, where you sort of took him around. You took him to Valois in Hyde Park. You took him to...
Well, yeah, he did. They didn't want to do stuff. So I mean, I had to talk them into going to Valois, and I had to talk them into going to the Lily Pond. And they thanked me very much.
I'll bet. That's how the show ended with...
Well, when you mentioned him, I knew him on the air and off the air.
Yeah.
And, he probably, when people asked me what he was like, I said, he's exactly like he is on TV,
exactly.
Except more so, I mean, he can say things that he can't say on TV.
Right.
But, yeah, there was nothing phony about him at all.
Yeah.
Zero.
What did you think of Bourdain? Because the show you did in Chicago, it haunts me because the
he gave me a different way of looking at my own business.
How so?
Well, I mean, the fact that he could write a book, I mean, it struck me. So, well, you know, you're in this nitty-gritty for so long. You try to perform an autopsy on it and see what makes things run, what makes things... And anybody with any ability for self-reflection will take and say, you know what, I'm going to look at something. Because I get a nagging feeling that something's not right in a particular corner of my business or something like that. You know, and it made me look at other people's businesses.
Yeah.
You know,
well, from
why do some tick, some don't?
Mm.
You know.
Jeff, what were your thoughts about Bourdain?
I'll tell you what, I had the good fortune, and because of good friend Bruce, that he brought him down to the Billy Goat for that segment, and I was honored by that, frankly. Even if certainly a unique personality. What I remember most so is how many women say, how many women were just enthralled the guy, and I would say, well, what is about that? I don't know, he's just so appealing to me.
Don't worry, Bruce, don't worry.
It and I guess all I could surmise is there was a little bit of the bad boy persona kind of woven into the grander
you have been at the Billy Goat for hundreds of TV cameras, big shots, presidents. You know, Sam Sianis and the family like that attention. But it doesn't change the place at all, I think. You know, it gets a little crowded. And the famous time that the late President Bush was down there and Mike Royko refused to come down to meet.
Do you remember the line? He was watching TV. It was about something about panties as evidence or something. It was,
Gary Dodson.
Yeah. How do you keep? I'm going to ask you. I'm keeping you all till 2:45, and then we're all going to do the exit interview with Ben Cortez here, who is leaving the station after 30 some years, and he is. Given the conversation we've had off air, he's terrified to do this because we're saying, "Who's the worst host? Who's the worst? Who's the worst?" I'll tell you.
He gave
off
us
air.
Some great clues.
Yeah, I'll tell you. We have great clues. Who's the worst host in the last 3 decades at WGN? That's what we're going to try to get out of Ben here. You ever had to throw a customer out, Jeff?
I'm trying to think now if we actually threw somebody out. There was some guy who came down the stairs and his before, I don't know, 10 minutes had elapsed or so, his pants fell off and he was unaware of it. So he had to be taken out. But I'll tell you, this may be just because of the luxury of the time slot in which I worked. I worked 11 to 7 almost my entire career there. And the place had a way of kind of policing itself. Indeed, if things kind of go haywire, it's going to happen more towards closing time. So no, in fact, I didn't. Rick, and I never relished that. As I mean, I never saw the job as kind of a power thing. You know,
right.
People. I mean, I think you know, I gave people enough latitude. You know, behaviorally behind the bar, you just think self reliance should rule the day, and you know, you try to nurture that. I had one thing that I would do. That I would encounter, as every bartender does, every owner, and a guy that you know is well beyond what he should be drinking at that point. And he says, "Look, I want another one," and people can occasionally become belligerent under that circumstance. The method I always used, and I've got to tell you, it never failed, was say, "Look, I know you want one, you know, but I can't serve because I can't. I won't feel okay. I want to know that you get home okay. I want you to be able to come back tomorrow."
Wow.
And I'll tell you, there are guys that say, "Listen, thanks a lot. Thanks for that." They'd slur that out, but they'd leave as long as you told them you cared about them.
What's your MO on that to the overserved customer? Funny,
a wise old Assyrian taught me once: people are only as crazy as you let them get. And you know what happens? I do something like that. I go paternal on them. I said, "You know what? You remind me so much of my son. I don't want anything to happen to you. And I know you're somebody's kid. So I'm going to look after you." And you know what? Generally, you almost have them with tears in their eyes. You can regress them, you know. I regress them to the point where they say, "Can I have a cup of water?"
Yeah. Bruce, I know you don't tend bar there, but you've seen...
Well, I could never get behind a bar with my personality. There'd be a fight every 3 minutes.
It'd be like mowing the Simpsons.
God. You want what? We want what?
First of all, I couldn't even remember what their orders are. I don't care what I go on.
Oh, all right. I'm going to talk to these gentlemen about what they think or wish or hope for in the new year after the news. So please stay tuned. Then we will all do the exit interview with Ben Cortez.
There's a somebody I'm longing to see.
That is, almost without argument, the greatest saloon singer ever, though he didn't spend too much time in saloons, rather in large concert arenas or Vegas. Frank Sinatra and Rick Cogan finishing up a fill-in for John Williams with three of my great friends, Jeff McGill, formerly of the Billy Goat Tavern, Colin Cordwell, currently of the Red Lion Pub, and Bruce Elliott, currently and for a long time now of the Old Town Ale House. Before Jeff has a few more thoughts about the value of a neighborhood tavern, but Colin Cordwell has a very interesting story about idiots who, when they want a drink, might start pounding on the bar with their empty glass.
Yeah, I was in Crickets one day, which was one of my favorite places.
Nice place.
It was a sophisticated little bar. It was an adult bar.
Yeah.
And there's a little Irish bartender named Patrick. And he was a real barman. And he was, I was probably in my 30s then. And you know what? Mentors always like to find students. I guess he must have looked at me like, this guy needs to learn some more. So he said, you ever got one of those guys who comes in and starts banging his glass on the bar? Hey, can I get another one? I said, yeah, I just had one the other night. He goes, you know what you do? I said, what? He said, you take a napkin, white napkin, bar napkin, write 257 on it. Hand it to him. He looks at it, he goes, 257. Yep. Number five.
That was a great one. Jeff, you had a couple more thoughts about the meaning and truth.
Yeah, it's got to come full circle for the day. We talked about the value of neighborhood taverns, and I happen to think that people didn't binge drink in neighborhood taverns. Their neighborhood reputation was on the line. These are guys that stopped after work, or they stopped in an afternoon on the weekend, whatever. And so drinking was kind of controlled phenomenologically in that respect. Another thing that I thought of, there was a story today on the radio about some guys. The oldest guy died 112 years old.
Yeah.
And we hear these things. We hear it all the time. What do you attribute your longevity to? And, of course, it's always cigars and whiskey. You know, in fact, I work with an old guy. I've got a part-time job to get out of the house and make some pocket money at a dental lab. And I take an old guy by the name of Wally Olawinski to work every day. He's 91 years old. He works 5 days a week. I work three. I feel like a slacker. But, you know, Wally, and we'll talk. We'll talk on the way, and that's our bar talk to and from the lab. And I said, Wally going to have, oh, yeah, he's going to have a couple belts every night. And so who am I to challenge the medicinal benefit of, you know, of a shot of booze? Anyway.
Yeah. Well, but we all know people that should not drink.
Right.
We all personally know these people.
Indeed.
Yes, and so we're not saying that drinking is harm. There are people that can't handle a drink, or there comes a time when they have to quit, which reminds me of Ebert, who was, you know, people did not realize what a heavy drinker he was, because he hung around with so many guys that drank even more than he did.
Yeah.
But I remember when it finally came time, and he almost smashed it in the North Avenue bus one night, and all of a sudden he's in AA, but he started coming back to O'Rourke's in the alehouse. And he'd proselytize. He'd say, hey, there's this place called AA.
He tried with me.
And now there was enough celebrity people, you know, star, you know what's, that they would. So he started actually kind of pulling people out of
Galloway.
Yes, there was a number of people. I told Roger after about 2 weeks of this, I said, Roger.
Get out of my bar.
I said, you have a life-threatening illness. It's not alcoholism. It's called obesity. And he didn't talk to me for a couple of years.
Yeah.
But, I mean, there are some people that can't drink. Mm-hmm. Now, I acknowledge that. And Roger was one. He definitely had reached the point. His friend John McHugh, a few years later, he couldn't drink anymore. And these were friends of mine.
My mother was one.
Mother was absolutely one. So we acknowledge that. We're not trying to, you know, sweep that under the rug. But people can. I mean, you don't want to see somebody destroy their life. Right now, I watch two or three people drink themselves to death.
Yeah.
Not in the alehouse. We won't serve them. But this is what this is what they've chosen to do. It's unfortunate and all, but.
Well, the great thing, the thing is, you can find a drink. You don't have to go to a tavern to find a drink. I mean, you go to Walgreens.
Yeah,
right.
You know
what I mean? Exactly. Yeah.
You've seen that too, Colin.
Oh, right? Yeah. You know what I've also discovered too? You can't really save people. You can curb people. You can't say, and you can't care more about a guy's life than he does. That's a fruitless enterprise.
Yeah.
You know, that's a fool's errand, you know.
And Jeff, I know you've seen those kinds of people during your more than three decades at the Billy Goat. I mean, that was a fairly hard drinking crowd down there.
Sure. Sure,
among them.
Remember years ago, I myself was drinking in the old John Weiss's tavern on Lincoln Avenue,
sure.
And a guy named Charlie Kelleher was tending bar. And you'd come in there in the early evening, and half the guys would have their heads down on the bar. You know, the guys that were drinking after work, and I would say to Charlie, I said, Charlie, what about this? I mean, do you feel like at some point, you know, you should, you know, intervene? And I remember he said to me, Jeff, what, and send them down to Consumers down the block? I mean, send them somewhere else. At least I care about mm-hmm. these guys. I see them every day. And so I kind of kept that understanding, you know, that they're going to go somewhere.
I think if anything's come of this wonderful conversation for the last hour and a half, it's that, yeah, there's certain inherent dangers with alcohol, but they sometimes can be outweighed by the benefits of the societal pleasures of a tavern, the ability to communicate with somebody else, the ability to, you know, I've seen a lot of retired guys who are not problem drinkers, and they get a great deal of, and I'm sure there's some at the Alehouse, I'm sure there's some at the Goat and at the Red Lion, who come in just to feel a sense of belonging.
They need to talk to somebody. They need to, they're not going to go pay for a psychiatrist. You know what, I had a buddy who was a shrink at Northwestern. He said to me one day, he said, I bet you they tell you stuff they don't tell me. I said, I guarantee you they tell me stuff they don't tell you.
Well, and also the whole phony nature of community that is Facebook or is Twitter or is Snapchat or is whatever else these things are, that's not to my mind, not a sense of community, Jeff.
This is disassociation.
No, in fact, there's a new app, I think, or it's been around for a while. What is it? Nextdoor Neighbor or something like that. That attempts to be, if you will, kind of the online, you know, neighborhood gathering place. But you know, human communication is too nuanced. You can't get that reading that. You've got to see people face to face, and indeed, you know, everybody. I suspect that everybody kind of has their right. There's kind of a correct intake of alcohol that probably works best for everybody. But whatever it is that may cause a reduction in defensiveness and inhibition, there's some gains to be made. There's gains to be made in human interaction if you can achieve that kind of comfortable spot.
Mm-hmm. When you're drinking, Count, do you drink?
I do.
Jeff, you don't drink much, do you?
I don't drink much. I did, you know, years ago, and it just kind of gradually tapered off, you know, behind the saloon. I mean, I went for the, you know, when the guy would come in and you know, set us all up, and you'd throw one down with them because it just, you wanted to keep things harmonious. And then you kind of, you know, you develop a facility for not having to do that. You can avoid those things, it's, you know, for obvious reasons.
You have to know what poisons you work well with.
Right.
You know, you really do. And it's, you chase it with water.
You drink. Sometimes you drink beer
with
ice.
Well, I have, in keeping with my history, I have a very esoteric illness called myasthenia gravis, which should be translated means extreme weakening of the muscles. And my muscles seem to be my tongue.
but thank God.
The muscle that's got the weakest. But when I went to the neurophysiologist who diagnosed me, he said that, well, do you drink? I said, yeah. He says, how often? I says, every day. Well, what? I said, well, I have about 15 beers. He went, what? I said, hey, I'm a teetotaler compared to my companions.
Mm-hmm.
So
keep it all in perspective.
I've had to because, I mean, I can't really just sit in a bar passively. So what I do is I drink what is known as a Polish martini, which is a Bud Light over ice. And I could drink 3, 4, 5 of those quite. I mean, it could for the whole duration, 2-3 hours in a bar. So, yeah, I drink, but that's moderation, definitely.
I got one called a pile driver. It's vodka and prune juice.
You guys have been amazing. This is, as long as I have a radio show, and if I don't have a radio show, we'll just do this in some saloon. Jeff McGill, formerly of the Billy Goat Tavern, and thinking of maybe putting some of his thoughts down on paper, as I think Colin and Bruce and I think you should.
Absolutely.
Colin Cordwell, the proprietor of the Red Lion Pub. That's... you'll find it online. Red Lion Pub. It's a great, great, beautiful bar restaurant just north of Fullerton on Lincoln Avenue. And the one and only Bruce Elliott, painter, fourth volume of his autobiography coming soon, podcaster with Liz Garibay, booze historian. The podcast produced by Rock and Roll Ruth, who's been sitting here patiently during this whole show. Gentlemen, you know how much I think of you. I think the world of all of you. We're going to take a commercial break, and then we're going to grill Ben Cortez about his 30 and more years at WGN, which comes to an end at 3 o'clock today. I'll tell you, it's that time of year again, and another chance to get something for someone who has everything. But deep down, we all want something truly meaningful for our loved ones. Well, We have just that, our 2019 Chicago personalized calendars. These calendars are so adored that we continue the tradition of offering them exclusively to our listeners now for more than a decade. This year, we bring you another series of breathtaking Chicago imagery. The best part is your family, friends, and co-workers will experience their names realistically crafted into every scene of our proud city. It's thoughtful, personal, and best of all, it's useful. Show someone how special you think they are all year long, produced by 2Ks and offered exclusively at WGN Radio. Each calendar is made to order with any name you choose. Get yours at WGNradio.com and scroll to the feature section and check out all our new 2019 Chicago personalized calendars. We'll be right back with Jeff McGill, Colin Cordwell, Bruce Elliott, and Ben Cortez.
Hi, it's Lou Manfredini, Mr. Fix-It from HouseSmarts Radio, and I'd like to thank you for listening to WGN Radio this past year.
Hi, Lou. Thank you.
Without you, none of us on the air would be here. So thank you for being part of our family for so many years. I'd like to wish you a happy, peaceful, and prosperous new year.
Thank you so much, Lou.
From Chicago's very own, 720 WGN.
The all-new Porsche Orland Park is now open in their new location. With all-new state-of-the-art Porsche service facility and expanded inventory, the all-new Porsche Orland Park, a Joe Rizza dealership, now open at 8760 West 159th Street. Visit them at PorscheOrlandPark.com.
Indeed knows finding the right hire takes time away from your business.
Hiring a qualified data engineer felt like a second job.
More job seekers use Indeed than any other site, so there's no better place to find someone with the skills you're looking for.
I needed someone with a master's in computer science and database experience.
Plus, Indeed screener questions help you find your shortlist fast.
Now I'm back to having just one job.
See why more than 3 million companies worldwide use Indeed to hire. Post your job at Indeed.com/hire. Indeed, the world's number one job site. Source.com score total visits.
The Store More, Save More event is going on now at the Home Depot, and it's the perfect time to get a handle on clutter. Even better, get an HDX 27-gallon storage tote, a special buy at just $8.98 each. They're tough, they're stackable, and each one can hold 75 pounds. That's some heavy-duty storage without the heavy-duty price. The Store More, Save More event is going on now at the Home Depot. More saving, more doing. Valid through February 4th, available in-store and online while supplies last.
Welcome back. This is me finishing off my fill-in for John Williams. I'm Rick Kogan. I'm on Sunday, too, so it's not my last day of the year. It does happen to be Ben Cortez's last day, not only of this year, but his last day at WGN. Engineers are one of the often overlooked. This station would not. Some of you have listened to GN for more than 30 years. Some of you probably listened for 90 years. One of the reasons it has sounded so good and made such sense is Ben Cortez. Jeff McGill, Colin Cordwell, Bruce Elliott, and I are going to do his exit interview. Ben, what are you going to miss beside me most of all here?
Well, yeah, no, really, you're hitting on the nail on the head. It's going to be the people that I work with here, because it's been a fun job because of all you guys that have worked with me over the years.
Ben, how'd you get into this business?
Kind of an odd way, because my brother listened to a lot of radio. I was never interested in radio, but just kind of by osmosis, I heard it a lot, and I just said, well, let me give it a try. And so I did my own show. And I would learn how to work the equipment. And
we're out of your basement or what? What do you mean your own?
No, I was on other radio stations.
So you were self-taught?
Yeah. Well, no, I went to Columbia College in U of I before that.
Mm-hmm.
So I was on the air at Columbia College, and I liked it. So I was looking for a job to do that, but they wanted somebody to run a board one day, and I got behind the scenes.
Well, Ben, you won't tell us who the worst person on our personality. Who was your favorite?
My favorite was probably, and it's hard to choose one because they're really close.
Present company excluded, of course.
Yeah, well, yeah. Probably Roy Leonard. Roy Leonard was a nice man.
Yeah, he was a very nice man.
He was, yeah. What you heard on the air was Roy Leonard's life.
He was a really nice guy.
Yeah.
He's coming to the pub.
Really? Oh, okay.
Yeah, Sunday in Colin, too.
Well, one of the other things about your job is at least I have learned, and I host a couple hours a week for the last few years, decade or so, you were always so enthusiastic when I'd have guests in that you liked. You were never overbearing.
Yeah.
But you know, someone like Dennis DeYoung, you were a huge fan. But that must have been, too, this must have been an amazing way for you to meet this huge, some who are probably not very nice, but an amazing gallery of people.
Over the years, I've met a ton of people, but I tried to hold back so I wouldn't seem to be overbearing. So obviously, I must have been successful. But and there's some that were just, you know, once they were off the air, it was entirely different.
Who's the worst guest who's ever been on this show? Then maybe Michael, saving all this for his memoir.
It's going to be in the book, yeah, definitely. But as I told one of the publishers, he published a book, Steve Alexander, everybody knows that he publishes books. I'm not sure, you know, I'm going to publish something, but as I told him, I said, I'm going to have to make it fictional because nobody's going to believe that I worked with this cast of characters that would be included. So
who's one who literally bowled you over, who you could not literally believe that you were shaking hands with or same studio?
Probably Dolly Parton.
Interesting.
But by the same token, she was one to quick exit. Like, she said, no, I can't do any pictures with anybody. So they sent us a little cutout of Dolly Parton. Like,
about a life size.
Yeah, well, yeah.
They said she was well over 4 feet tall.
Yeah. And she... she wouldn't take the picture with me, so I had the producer take a picture with me in the cutout. I had at least that, because she didn't. She just walked away. She just said, no pictures, guys.
How many years have you worked there? 30s.
The ironic thing about it, today is the day I started. The date
no.
I started. Yes. So 35 years ago today.
Wow.
Gee whiz.
On December 28th, 1983.
Jeff, how long did you attend Bart the Billy Goat?
35 years. All right. Well, 3 months shy of that. Okay. You know, Ben, I was going to ask you, Rick alluded to the celebrities that somehow found their way down to the Billy Goat over the years. What I always found about that, for me personally, and I've also thought about this for Rick, for all the people that he's interviewed and who he's met over the years, there's something oddly liberating about it, isn't there? Because you see people warts and all. You really do. They can't hide them.
Yeah.
Do you feel the same way?
Yeah, I think the people that came in here, they were pretty much, they let the guard down. I mean, they just came in here and just were themselves for the most part. And there's some where they were really too much of themselves. I remember Roy, you were seeing the worst guest. Roy had a hard time with Michael Anthony Hall from Breakfast Club. We don't know what he was on that day, but he was just like all over the place dancing in the studio and wouldn't stay still. And there was something definitely changing his personality. We don't know what it was.
Tom Cruise syndrome.
But it was not right.
Tom Cruise on Oprah.
Was not a good interview.
Bruce, what would you like to ask Ben?
Well, I still want to know who the worst is.
Ben, might you be available for Last Night at the Old Town Ale House podcast? Ruth, you could sign him up now for doing that. You're still a young, vital guy. Do you have plans now for your...
I've got a few irons in the fire, yeah.
Do you want to tell us sort of what they are? Professional golfer?
No. My first plan is I got to decompress a little bit because I've been getting up at 2:30 in the morning since 1987.
Whoa.
So
I have two, but then I go
and
back
it's winter time now, so it's even worse. It's even worse during the winter.
Tell me about is your wife pleased? Or is she worried?
Oh, no. Well, she was included in the decision whether I should take the buyout or not. But yeah, she's a nurse, so she still can.
So you,
he's planning on working.
You still got health care covered, right?
Yeah.
That's a big one. That's a big one. Now, I know you you were fond of Dennis DeYoung. It was on. You've been to a few.
Yeah.
You've been to some of the same concerts anymore. This station does not play much music.
No.
A little Frank Sinatra in short little cribs and drabs. Could you work for a music station? Would you like that, do you think?
Yes. In fact, when I started out, it was a music station I worked at. And I liked that a lot. We did play some music on, like, the weekends with Roy Leonard or somebody like that. But, I would definitely consider a music station.
Given the nature of the show we have just had for almost 2 hours... did you and could you, getting up at 2 o'clock in the morning would make your after-work drinking schedule a little tough. Did you go out after work for a drink here and then?
Yes. Really?
Where would you go?
Well, we were up on Bradley Place mostly at that time. So, a lot of places around there. And funny thing is they asked me the first time they talked to me. That
Do you drink?
No. They asked me if I would work a 4 a.m. to noon shift. And in my mind, I was thinking like, okay, well, I'm usually getting in about that time. So I was only 26. So I'm trying to figure out like, well, where am I going to sleep? But I don't want to tell the boss that because this is a potential job. So I said, oh, yeah, sure, no problem. So I did have to come back then and not go out as late. But I did still go out.
You think you're still going to get up really early?
I think my body clock will do that. Without me even trying, because even on my days off, I do wake up at that time and look at the clock, but it's comforting to say, oh, I can just turn over and go to sleep.
Well, you will be missed here. You and I have worked a lot together over the years, that more Sunday morning show, and then, occasional fill-ins like this.
Yeah.
And it's kind of like a weird honor for me to be here in your last kind of thing. You know, maybe Fiona is somewhere saying now, but Dad, he's the only engineer I've ever known, which would be true because Fiona has.
We feel honored as well, Rick.
Huh?
Yeah, we do.
Yeah, I know.
Honored too.
Yeah, but we have respect for history and respect for a job well done.
Yes. You know, we've done this how many years now, Rick? Is this the fourth?
Oh yeah, this
about
is
the fourth.
Third or
we've done this.
Third or fourth.
And I got to tell you, of course, you are going to make anybody feel comfortable. But there's also that guy. And every time I've done this, and I was certainly nervous about it the first time, mostly, but it kind of is always kind of with me. Right. And you also have made me feel very. Oh,
well, thank you for saying so. We try to make you feel comfortable because it makes for a better radio show too. So,
I will tell you now, if you ever show up at the Red Lion when Colin's there, and you ever show up at the Old Town Ale House when Bruce and Ruth are there, drinks are on me.
Okay.
I'm hoping they will both pay for me. But
oh, course. Sure.
Yeah.
Let's go one leg in German. Bang, bang.
Guys, I'm glad you could share this thing. I'm glad we could do this, what has become a New Year's Eve-ish tradition, because I learned something every single time. Elif Garris, I hope to be here at your 35th year and say goodbye to you too. But Elif Garris is an incredibly talented young producer here usually for John Williams, but for me for the last 2 hours. Brian Noonan is coming up now. Brian, are you available to...
I am always available to say hello to you, Rick.
Well,
it is always a pleasure. And I also want to, if I may, I would like to extend my congratulations to Ben as well. Now, I did it to him in person, but now I'll do it on the air, because really, if we don't live it on the air, it didn't happen.
That's true.
So Ben has been very nice to me since the day I walked through the doors, and... you know, we talked a lot about our daughter's college careers because his daughter followed mine down to New Orleans. And he's
always a dangerous college town.
Yeah, you got to really make sure your child has their head on straight. I couldn't have survived there. And I said that every time I went to visit, every time I went down there, I said, I would have been dead if I went to college here. But thankfully, my daughter and Ben's daughter are level-headed young women who actually wanted to study, which is amazing to me.
That's hard to believe. Yeah, talk to me for a second, Brian, about, I'm trying to get at the point that the engineers here are really the unsung heroes. I mean, these guys are actually... the ones driving the plane. I mean, they are like the bartenders, and those of us who are hosts are just like the interesting and or boring customers.
I can run enough. I can push enough buttons to stay on the air, but once I push that button, I have no idea what happens down the line. And there have been many times, especially when I was doing overnights, where thank God there was an engineer here, because it's like, something happened. And I have no comprehension of what that is. But one of them calmly walks in. Oh, boom, 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 boom.
Yeah.
Everything is fixed. And now I can sound, like I know what I'm doing again.
Ben Cortez, you have had an amazing career here, and I can't wait to read the book. Bruce Elliott will be the first one to buy it. It will be
absolutely.
Bruce is going
to
call
that worst person.
Yeah,
me too. I was waiting for that too. I was like,
you got a lot of potential buyers out there. Ben, you take care. Brian, you have a great show. All of you, I'll be blabbering Sunday night.
We'll talk to you then, Rick. Thanks.